All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Yeah, okay, well, once again, we're on right here at WAAM, our flagship station. This is Veterans Radio. I'm Bob Gould, bringing you another military program, military history, military music, military talk. Everything's military. Anyway, today, speaking of military, we're going to be talking about the Battle of the Bulge. Why? Because today is the anniversary. It is the 73rd anniversary, if I'm not mistaken.
And the battle officially began yesterday, December 16th.
Oh, by the way, who do I have in the studio with me? I have, on my left, Drake.
Big Mouth Drake, here I am.
And I have Eric.
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you both. And we'll be getting down to their, you know, who are these guys, right? But they're going to be giving me a hand at speaking about being in the service. Eric was in the 82nd Airborne. I won't even go there, Eric. No, not a bit. Because we're going to talk a lot about the 101st, but Airborne's Airborne. And if we got a chance, oh, by the way, Eric had two tours. One tour in Afghanistan and one tour in Iraq. And Drake had one tour in Ypsilanti. No, where were you? You were in the Air Force, right?
Actually, the main part of my tour was with the Army Reserve in Livonia. Deployment fort was Fort Benning, and a little bit of activity out at Fort Custer in Battle Creek.
Were you at Benning?
I wasn't there for any real length of time, but that was where I went for annual training and stuff like that.
This is going to be
That's where I drank beer, Bob, down at Fort Benning.
I mean, where else can you get three guys together? I mean, I don't think we've ever worked together, right? No.
I was on with you a month ago for 10 minutes. Yeah, I mean, I feel hurt.
We've all been to Fort Benning. Yeah, Fort Benning,
it's
Columbus,
awesome
Georgia. Mm-hmm. A stockade at Columbus. All right. Well, we're going to want to be getting right soon, but I got a couple of things to be talking about. First of all, Tuesday, December 19th, the Centerline VFW Post Auxiliary is hosting a free thank you lunch to all veterans on active duty and first responders. How many guys on active duty are going to be around? Why didn't they just make it on whatever, you know, make it for all veterans, right? I mean, really, I think active duty, I don't want to question that. So it's going to be the Centerline VFW Post located in Centerline, Michigan. So go to their website, I'm sure, on Friday, December 22nd. The Vets Returning Home is having another In Their Country concert series. And this time it's at the Emerald Theater in Mount Clemens. The doors open at 6 o'clock. There we are. Yeah, cold outside, folks. It's a country concert series. It opens at 6 o'clock. Tickets are $10, $15 at the door. So that's the 22nd in Centerline. I'm sure if you Google that in Centerline, you'll find that. Also, it's going to be at the Yankee Air Museum, and I don't have the time, unfortunately. December 21st, it's going to be with Santa. Do things with Santa. And it's free for kids. Adults, they got to pay the admission charge, but it's free for the kids. Meet Santa at the Yankee Air Museum. What time? Give them a call. Right. Yeah, I mean, y'all got all those smartphones and all that. So, look it up. That's the Yankee Air Museum, December 21st. Not just for the kids in the Santa, but there's a lot of, equipment, military equipment and airplanes. And you're in the Air Force. You ever seen?
No, I was in the Army Reserve.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I got you with Air Force. But have you guys ever seen an
airplane? Maybe I look high.
Have you ever seen an F-4 Phantom? How big they are?
Not up close and personal, no.
And there's just a little guy, and he's sitting on a Roman cannel. How they ever had the, to get into that thing. There was no armament other than they dropped bombs. That's it. There's no defense. I think it was they felt that the airplane could have jamming equipment, whatever, and outrun and outthink and outsmart the enemy. But when you look at this, it's a Roman candle. It's just one big engine and fuel. I don't know how many bombs they carried, one or two, three or four. It didn't look like that many at the time, but good gosh, that thing is big. But anyway, that's the Yankee Air Museum, and that'll be on December the 21st. Okay, let's get right in to our guest. Our guest today, Kevin Hemel. Kevin has been one of our regulars. It's been a while since he's been on. I think it's almost a year, mostly because I haven't been around. But Kevin's with us today. He's an historian for the U.S. Air Force Surgeon General at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. He's also a historian tour guide for Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours. And he gives World War II tours on D-Day, the Band of Brothers, and, he gives World War tours on D-Day. Oh, yeah, the Band of Brothers and General George S. Patton's battlefields. He's also been the research director for Sovereign Media, publishes World War II History and World War II History Quarterly Magazine. He continues to write articles there. He's a former historian, another historian for the U.S. Combat Studies Institute at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He has also wrote, Eric, this will be, let's see if we two guys can get into this after we do this Battle of the Bulge business. He did some research and wrote on Afghanistan, but you guys have a few things to say. Maybe we'll cover that. Okay, what else we got? He's worked for more than, books. He's written Patton's photographs. Next time you see a photograph of Patton, look underneath his binoculars. You're going to see a camera. You're going to see a camera. This guy took thousands and thousands of photographs. He says, I want to present the war the way I saw it. And Kevin researched them, put a lot of them, give nice book, nice coffee table book. In fact, what do we got? Christmas coming up. I bet if you went to Amazon, they'd have it for you tomorrow. That is Patton's Photographs, yes. And the other book was Patton, Legendary World War II Commander. He's appeared on the History Channel, American Heroes Channel, and Fox News Channel. He's also worked for more than 20 years for various military and military history magazines and journals. He's worked as a researcher for the National Archives and as a historian for an archaeological company. He holds a master's degree in American history from Villanova University.
Real quick, before we get started, I'm just dying to say this, Bob. Dying to say this. Did you know that the Battle of the Bulge was not always known as the Battle of the Bulge? The Allies had deemed it the Ardennes Offensive. The Ardennes Counteroffensive. The contemporary media at the time labeled it Battle of the Bulge because of the bulge in the German lines, and that's when it took off, and we know it as that. But I want to say, ironically, the first major German offensive in the West was through the Ardennes when they went into France and the Low Countries. And ironically, it was their last major offensive in the West, which is what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
The former Ardennes counteroffensive, also known as Battle of the Bulge.
Well, I think that's a pretty good beginning here to introduce Kevin. Kevin, how are you? Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, doing fine. Good to hear from all three of you.
Yeah, man, it's been a while. I saw you on the History Channel the other day. Good job. I believe it was.
Did I look good?
I think it was on the Battle of the Bulge. Where I wanted to start, not so much on what happened, who did what, where. This had to be the actual Ardennes battle had to come from somebody's brainchild, and I don't believe it was Hitler. I mean, he might have said we should do something, but who put that together? And at what point before December before it was launched, what general, whatever, in the military command? Kevin?
Sure. Well, I hate to say this, but it really was Adolf Hitler's idea. He formulated it after the July 20th bomb plot when he almost lost his life while he was recovering. He came up with the idea and put General von Rundstedt in charge of it. And then his army commanders then took it from there. But it really was Hitler's brainchild, and he meant for it to be a big November offensive, but the Germans couldn't gather enough troops or equipment for it, and so they had to keep pushing the date back. And in a way, fortunately for them, they struck just as the weather turned really poor. The first 3 days of the offensive, there was the seasonal fog that really hit that part of Europe that completely blinded the Allies' air cover and reconnaissance cover. And so when they launched out of the woods there in the Ardennes on the German border, we were not able to call in airstrikes to figure out what was going on for 3 or 4 days into the actual battle. But yeah, unfortunately, it was Adolf Hitler's brainchild. And in a way, it was a great boon for the U.S. Army because the Germans came out from behind their defenses and we were able to carve them up into little pieces. That by the end, by January 17th, 1945, there was no effective fighting force, you know, in the European theater. He ships his SS armored divisions west to try to, you know, plug the gaps that the Russians have. He does launch another offensive called Norwind, south of Belgium and around what's called the Colmar Pocket in France. And that one gets snuffed out rather rapidly. And that's why they call it the Ardennes counteroffensive, because, in the U.S. Army, I guess, history branch, they wanted to include Operation Norwind. So it wasn't just the bulge up in Belgium and Luxembourg. It was also, the follow-up attack, in sort of central and southern France to try to keep the Allies off balance, which both of them just come to ruinous endings.
Now, I think the bulge line was over 200 miles, and the center was an 85-mile strip. I don't believe it was that well defended. But anyway, that's what the Germans hit. And, oh, go ahead.
Kevin, I have a question for you. Is it true that before the Germans launched their offensive, Battle of the Bulge, that a lot of the Americans that were in that sector were told that this is a fairly peaceful region, take some R&R, and the Allies were totally just caught blind by the Germans' buildup and their come across and attacking the Americans because of the Germans' radio silence and other secret, you know, techniques, if you will, took us by total surprise. But my point is, were the Americans in that sector initially basically thinking, hey, we're here to relax and recover from our previous fighting?
That's exactly what it was. The Ardennes was considered a peaceful front. We put two rookie divisions in, if not actually about three rookie divisions in there. And the 28th Infantry Division, which had taken such a mauling at the Battle of Herkton Forest, was put down there to recover. And the real belief in the high Allied command, well, belief number one, the German army was spent and there would be no action for the winter. There was some belief that if there was any action, it would be up north in a city called Aachen, which the Allies had taken and was the first German city captured. So the assumption is Hitler's going to want to take back his precious city. And so all eyes were further north. But other than that, the real belief was that the war was going to settle down for the winter. You know, the Ardennes was this peaceful region. And, you know, you had mentioned earlier how the Germans launched their offensive in 1940 through the Ardennes offensive, mm-hmm. through the Ardennes forest. Yet there was this pervasive belief in the U.S. Army that, oh, they can't do that again. I don't know where that kind of belief came from. Maybe the belief that American armor was having difficulties in a tree, you know, in a heavily forested area like they did in the Herkton Forest. But it really was a blind spot. The only person that really kind of foresaw any kind of trouble was General Patton, whose army wasn't anywhere near the Ardennes. There's a famous citation out of his diary that Martin Blumenson used and you know, subsequent historians, that he looked north and he said, you know, First Army is not exercising its troops. They're sitting on their butt. You know, they should be more active in case there's an offensive there. But I found in his diaries right at early December when Patton was planning his own offensive, he had taken three divisions and put them in reserve. And his idea was two of his corps would blast forward, you know, kind of clear the battlefield. And then the third corps with these three divisions would blast through. And in his diary, he's talking about this. And then he puts in a sentence and he says, and if the Germans attack further north, parentheses, which is possible, I can use these three divisions to push north. So, I mean, it is really in his brain before the first shot is fired in the battle. And I should mention that on the German side, the 7th Army commander, his name was Brandenburger, when he was given his assignment, his first reaction was, what about Patton? He said, when we do this, I bet you General Patton's going to turn north and plow right through my army. And because of that argument, his superiors gave him some tanks. But 7th Army really didn't have many tanks, but it was that fear of Patton that got him those tanks.
There's been some that said that this is really between Bradley and Modell, the Battle of the Bulge. Bradley being in charge of the 12th Infantry Division and Modell being the commander of the German forces. I like this one shot that I see, and I've seen it in a photograph and I've seen it on a film, where Bradley, I love this, where he's in a Jeep, he's riding shotgun, and there looks like a PFC or what is asking him for his ID. Tell us about that.
Sure. The Germans, part of their strategy in the Battle of the Bulge was to disguise German commandos as American MPs and soldiers to get behind the lines, cut communications wires, set up roadblocks, and just basically cause chaos at a number of bridges until the German armor forces could get to them and take those bridges to keep the offensive rolling. And once this was discovered, because the Germans would make small mistakes, like they would say, you want to go down that road a couple of meters. They wouldn't say yards or miles. And so there's these little inflections that they failed kind of uncovered them. So once we realized that, you know, the Germans were disguising themselves as American troops, MPs and other soldiers just started creating sort of American trivia passwords to anyone they weren't sure who they were. And Omar Bradley was late on a number of occasions to important meetings because he was being stopped by MPs asking him who won the 1939 World Series.
I was just going to say something like that.
Who was Betty Grable married to? You know, things that Germans just wouldn't know. And, Bradley and a number of generals stumbled over these questions before they finally convinced the MPs who they were. Remember, this is a time without television. And still photos are kind of where a lot of the GIs are getting their information from, Stars and Stripes. And so a lot of these, to us, very famous generals and very recognizable generals aren't as recognized to the troops of the front. So it was quite a bit of confusion that the Germans were able to sort of set over the entire American battle area during this fight.
Well, that brings us to, okay, we're at the Bulge, and here come the Germans, and here are the Americans. But I understand that Bradley didn't really believe that this was an offensive, and it was Eisenhower who said, oh, no, we got to do something. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. When, in fact, Eisenhower was visiting Bradley's headquarters when the report started coming in and the arrows started going up on the map. And Bradley says, you know, it looks like a local spoiling attack. And Eisenhower takes one look at the map and he said, no, that's a counteroffensive. He realized the impact of it. And he ordered Bradley immediately to send the 7th Armored Division, which was up north, south, and the 9th and 10th Armors in the south, north, to start pinching it off. And Bradley says to Eisenhower, you know, Patton's not going to like this, because he's getting ready to use the 10th Armored Division in attack. And Eisenhower just snapped back. He said, tell him Ike is running the damn war.
Woo.
And it really was Eisenhower taking the grips of his armies to engage the Germans immediately. It was a very impressive response. And, of course, once he commits these three armored divisions, within 12 hours, maybe less, he realizes just how big this is and calls in his only reserves, which are the 82nd and 101st Airborne Division. So Eisenhower does a great job of seizing up what is going on despite all the confusion turning his offensive capabilities right into the German attack.
Okay. Now, when this started, the Americans had air superiority. So you would think anything that would happen would be immediately, but there was bad weather, and when that cleared up, right after Christmas, right around Christmas Day, there was a big air battle, and a lot of airplanes, a lot of German planes were shot down, and a lot of American planes. I mean, we're talking a large air battle in January 45. Tell us about that.
Sure. It happens on New Year's Day. The belief is that the Americans are going to be celebrating New Year's, and they'd be hungover and everything on January 1st. So the Luftwaffe is able to scrape together 1,000 airplanes. However, the pilots are of questionable skill and ability, and they raid the entire American front. They come in, they fly in low at different air bases and drop bombs on the planes getting ready to taxi. I believe there were a number of Spitfires on the way back from a patrol that encountered these Germans and basically ran right through them. The German pilots, being so young and inexperienced, that they didn't react well to well-trained pilots. There's a famous scene that this one pilot, and I should mention too, that on the ground, the American ground crews were quite alert, knocking down a number of German airplanes. But one of the pilots was shot down, and when he was taken, you know, prisoner, they brought him in front of the airbase commander, and he said, "Look what we've done to your Air Force," and, you know, kind of swept his hands at all these knocked out American airplanes. And he said, "You know, Germany's going to win this war." And a week later, they called for him again. I think it was about a week, if not shorter. And the air commander showed him that all of the planes had been replaced with brand new Mustangs and, you know, P-51, P-38, and just said, "Okay, look what we just did." And the German was in complete shock. So it was sort of the Battle of the Bulge being the last gasp, the Ardennes offensive being the last gasp of the German army. It was also the last gasp of the Luftwaffe, because so many scores of planes were shot down. Like I said, at this point in the war, the German pilots were just very young and inexperienced. They had not been able to replace the losses they had experienced both on the Eastern Front and the Western Front.
Kevin, I got a question for you. Is it true that the German offensive was intended to stop the Allied use of the Belgian port of Antwerp and to split the Allied lines, allowing the Germans to encircle and destroy 4 Allied armies and force the Western Allies to negotiate a peace treaty in the Axis' favor, allowing then Hitler to focus on the Eastern Front? Is that what Hitler's true goal was? And it being 2017, the benefit of hindsight, was any of that really realistic and feasible on the Germans' part to actually succeed at that?
You're correct. That was the goal, was the port of Antwerp. The secondary goal was to split the American and British armies from each other, and then they would be in such desperate straits, they would be more than willing to sign a peace treaty with the Germans. And that's kind of what happened in 1940. The German army did separate the British army from the French army. You know, the British army famously retreating to Dunkirk. But the Allies, when all of this was going on, they still couldn't fathom this idea. This was so pie in the sky that they thought that the Germans were going to the French city of Lille. They thought that's as far as they could go. Now, this offensive never even makes it to France. The Meuse River was what divides Belgium from France, and they never even crossed the Meuse River. They were stopped short of it. They make it about not even barely half the distance that their objective is. So it really was this grandiose plan of Adolf Hitler, this belief that, you know, this resurgence of the German military was going to drive the Allies to its knees. In fact, he believes that by the time word gets back to President Roosevelt and Roosevelt figures out what to do, they'd be in Antwerp. What he didn't realize is the buck stopped with General Eisenhower, who was reacting from day one, and the American Army of 1944 was a far cry from the French Army of 1940. Much more active, much more aggressive army, much more mobile, much more artillery, air power. Every category, we were beating the Germans except probably one. And that was our medium tanks compared to their heavy tanks, which proved to be rather slow and had a hard time in maneuvering in the woods. And if I could make one point, you had talked about this earlier, and I wanted to get back to it. German communication prior to the Battle of the Bulge, you know, saying, how do they surprise us? We were intercepting and interpreting all German communications thanks to Ultra, which was a cracking of basically the German code. Well, for about a month prior to the Battle of the Bulge, German commanders were told only to use wire communication, not to send anything over the radio, and that's how they prevented the Americans from finding out, just simply by using ground wire instead of going over the air with their plans. And that was one of the main ways they kept everything secret.
Now, that is fascinating. I did not know that, and that's fascinating. Can't say any
Well, that's
any
why you
that.
Guys call me.
Yeah, well, that's why you're on the air right now. Okay, we've got less than 2 minutes, but I want to wrap this part up. You brought up something I've never thought about. How long was it after the attack started that Roosevelt was told?
You know, I have been interested in that aspect of the Battle of the Bulge for a long time. I have never seen any evidence of him ever mentioning the Battle of the Bulge in communiques, in speeches, in anything. And I've talked to several Roosevelt historians and asked them about this, because here's this, you know, basically the greatest crisis for the Western Allies in World War II, short of Kasserine Pass in North Africa, which would have been 1943. But here's this giant counteroffensive that is so important in the European theater, and Roosevelt never mentions it. So I don't know when he was told this, but he really left it to his general.
Well, the orchestra is just standing up, and they're getting ready. In fact, they've already started. We got our break. Can you believe we're halfway through? Kevin, I know you're going to come right back. This is Bob Gould, Drake, and Eric Town. There we are.
Tower.
Right.
See, I don't have a last
name. Veterans Radio in WAAM 1600 on your AM dial. Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. I was with Eric over here in the halftime there during the break. And Eric, you got something. You got a question.
Yes, Kevin. I was curious to back up a little bit. You had mentioned Eisenhower committing his own reserves of the 101st and the 82nd. Being an 82nd member myself, you know, could you elaborate a little bit more on how Eisenhower employed both the divisions?
Sure. So the original plan was for the 82nd Airborne to head to Bastogne, and the 101st would to head north to a place called Webermont. And through a series of almost coincidences, that got turned around. The Bastogne itself at the time was the Corps headquarters, and so General Middleton is there organizing his defense. And as the 101st and 82nd headed out, the 101st temporary commander, I should mention, General McAuliffe, takes a jeep straight into Bastogne to get instructions from Middleton about what they should do once they set up. And so because he drives into Bastogne, Middleton says, no, bring your division here. We need them desperately. The Germans are driving directly for Bastogne. So instead of heading right back to his division, he actually drives around Bastogne to get the idea of how to set up his division. Meanwhile, the 101st in about 380 trucks is in a convoy right behind the 82nd Airborne, and the 82nd gets stuck in traffic. So one of the commanders for the 101st says, you know what, I bet if we detour around and go through Bastogne, we can get, we won't be two divisions on a single road. And he asked an MP, he said, hey, has anybody gone down this road into Bastogne? And he said, yeah. General McAuliffe, the head of the 101st, and he said, well, I'll just follow him. And that's how the 101st Airborne Division ends up in Bastogne. Now, the 82nd Airborne is going to head north, and they're basically going to relieve parts of the 7th Armored Division, which has been fighting since day one around St. Vith. And the 82nd is really kind of going to bolster the 7th Armored Division. In fact, at one point, an element of the 7th Armored gets surrounded. And so these tankers, okay, these guys in heavy armored vehicles and tanks need relief. They send the 82nd Airborne Infantry in to get them. And I talked to one of the veterans of the 7th Armored. He said, these 82nd Airborne guys showed up. We said, we're surrounded. They said, don't worry. and the 82nd Airborne Infantry started kind of leapfrogging each other on left and right sides of the road and pushed the Germans out of the way so these tanks could roll out and not be surrounded. That's the kind of professionalism the 82nd and 101st bring to the battlefield. If I could just talk about the 101st real quick at Bastogne, you know, they are going to support elements of the 10th Armored Division. And the Germans are pushing, you know, west on Bastogne, so an entire regiment goes out there to relieve them. Well, north of Bastogne in the town of Noville, there's this small group, about 400 soldiers and about 15 tanks and a couple of tank destroyers holding off an entire German division. And the commander of this, Major de Sauvry, radios back to Bastogne and says, hey, can I pull back? And everyone in Bastogne knows there is no place to pull back. And the commander says, you know, hey, there's the 1st Battalion of the 506 is coming up the road with Commander LaPrada. You can pull back if you want, but I got airborne troops coming to you. And this turns de Sauvry around. He actually sent a jeep to get LaPrada so they can plot their attack, not a defense, but to go on the attack against an armored division. And so by them coordinating together, they hold the Germans at bay at Noville and prevent them from entering Bastogne. At one point, German tanks are firing on paratroopers from the 1506. They're getting thrown out of their foxholes from these cannon blasts from 88. And instead of pulling back into Noville, they just climb back in their holes and keep fighting. That's the kind of professionalism and bravery that these guys are bringing to the battlefield. Not to demean any of the other troops, because they all have been fighting for days against these Germans, but the airborne divisions are an incredible shot in the arm to those soldiers defending those important locations from the German army.
McAuliffe, General McAuliffe, who was a commander at that time of the 101st Airborne Group that was defending Bastogne, I got to ask you this, Kevin. I think I've asked you this before, but there may be a couple of listeners that never heard me ask this, and I see it.
You're gonna ask.
You know, well, let me ask it first. I got to ask it because, well, the Germans gave the airborne a chance to surrender, okay? And they sent a note to McAuliffe on a jeep. Officer walked up, and McAuliffe wrote back a response. And General McAuliffe read it, the German general read it, and it said, nuts, I don't believe that. Is that true?
Well, I'll tell you the story. So the Germans do offer a surrender. Now, they surround Bastogne, right, on about the 21st, and on the 22nd, the German jeep drives through the American line with a white flag, so they blindfold the two gentlemen and send them to McAuliffe's headquarters. They've got a surrender request, and it basically says, you fought nobly, but this is a waste of time, and if you don't surrender, we're going to hit you with an artillery barrage. It's really just going to knock you guys all out. McAuliffe, you know, had been dispersing his troops off for the last 3 days with very little sleep. He finally got a nap in, but he's woken up from his nap. And he handed this note, and he's exhausted. He goes, oh, nuts, I got to deal with this. And so he goes around the table to his officers, to his staff, and says, okay, how should I respond? And they all have a different answer. And they come to Harry Kennard, his operations officer, and Kennard says, you know, sir, the first thing you said really nailed it. They said, what did I say? He said, you said nuts. And he says, okay. And so he jots this note down in response to the German commander, nuts. They give it to this German officer. They blindfold him. They drive him back out to the lines. They take the blindfold off. And the German says, hey, can I read this before I go back? And they said, yeah. And he opens it up, and he just looks at it, and he says, nuts. Nuts. What does this mean?
The
American sergeant said, it means go to hell. And now I got to be honest with you, and I've been kicking myself for decades for this. I actually called Harry Kennard, the operations officer, and talked to him for a half hour back in like 1998. And I never even mentioned the nuts thing because he had taken over command of the 1st Cav in Vietnam. And I was working for Vietnam Magazine looking for pictures for an article we were running. And he was really nice. He was in Arlington, Virginia at the time. And we had a nice chat for a half hour. And about 2 weeks later, it dawned on me who he was. And I was like, oh, I never asked him. So, but that is the story. Now, there have been a lot of rumors that have cropped up. But, you know, I'll tell you a quick story to me that shows you that I think it really was legit. Another group of American troops had gotten surrounded, a battalion from the 30th Infantry Division at a place called Mortain back in August. They got surrounded. A surrender request went to them, and the lieutenant responded, "Go F yourself." You know, we fill in the F. And that actually got published in Stars and Stripes 2 weeks later. So, the American Army is not shy about using such kind of rough language. They're not too worried about public affairs. They're dealing in the moment. And so I think if they're willing to use that term at Mortain and nobody caught any grief for it, I can't see what would have held McAuliffe back from using stronger language. But that really was his decision. And there's never been any solid evidence any other way than that nuts story. Sorry.
Hey, Kevin, you really hit home with me regarding the explanation of the nuts story, because I remember as a kid watching World War II movies and as a young adult and even up to the present, just hearing that response from McAuliffe, nuts, I always wondered, what does that really mean? I was probably more along the lines of the German receiving the message, not understanding it. I assumed, I hoped it meant you're all nuts, we're not going to surrender, well, you know, the tenacity to keep fighting. But I never really knew for sure, and so now we've addressed it, maybe I can sleep at night.
You're in good company, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, Eric.
Sure, happy to help.
Yeah, Kevin, I'm kind of curious to follow off of Drake. What was the German commander's response to nuts? Is there any indication of how he responded?
Yeah, it was a very weak artillery barrage in the response. But when you mean, you know, what was the actual response, that is unknown. But it was the German corps commander who had sent this message, and the army commander was furious with him for even doing it. Because he said, we don't have the power to back up what we're saying, because that was supposed to be, you know, within 12 hours of that note, there was going to be this giant artillery barrage that was going to wipe Bastogne off the face of the earth, and it was a relatively weak barrage, because remember, the Germans' goal is Antwerp. So these two armored divisions and an infantry division that attacked Bastogne early on, those two German armored divisions are sent further west. They've got a job to do. And so the Bastogne is eventually surrounded by an infantry unit with a handful of tanks. And what they decide to do, because they've tried the front door, they've tried the side door, their last attack is going to be on the back door. But the Germans don't have the vehicles to move their infantry, so they've got to go by foot. So there were all these battles on the 19th and the 20th. They can't attack Bastogne again in strong numbers until the 25th on Christmas Day. And that gives the Americans inside Bastogne a great deal of time to sort themselves out, get organized, and brace for the next attack. The Germans just aren't as strong as they're bragging to be in Bastogne. Now, eventually, Hitler is going to turn several armored divisions south to attack Bastogne once it becomes the real focus of the Battle of the Bulge. It goes from a sideshow to almost a main show. And you know, Patton is feeding in at least two armored divisions and an infantry division after he breaks through. So it really does become the focus of the whole, you know, campaign. But yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have an exact answer about the army commander's reaction when he finds out what his corps commander did.
Okay, folks, to get fuel to the American Army in December of 1944, it took just as much fuel to get there, to get the fuel there, because everything was coming in from Normandy. Now, this is all going to change because even though Antwerp was in Allied hands, there was the estuary was still under German hands. So the idea of fuel was very important. The Americans had to get that open. But so was it important for the Germans. And Model went to Piper. Joachim Piper. Oh, what an evil guy. But we will talk about that in a minute. He came with 400 tanks. They were Tiger tanks. And by the way, those had 7 inches of armor in front. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, Piper has got the main job of reaching Antwerp. And he's given a very strong force of tanks to do this with. Now, unfortunately, with heavy tanks, they need solid bridges to cross. And American engineers are basically blowing everything up in his face. And at one point, he gets to this area where three rivers come together called Trois Ponts. And the bridge blows up in his face, and he says, those damn engineers. Now, I should mention that the troops under him, their homes had been bombed. They had been at war for a long time. And the order kind of went down the pike. You know, we don't have time or consideration to take prisoners. And that's exactly what happens in a number of towns. Any American surrendering, they shoot them. And in the first couple of towns, the numbers are like, you know, 10 and 20 and stuff like that. But then they get to this crossroads called Bog Nez, and they come across an observation battalion, basically, an ordnance unit for the 7th Armored Division. And these guys surrender peacefully, and they round them up, and Piper and his tanks, you know, continue west. Well, you know, they're kept in this field, and a vehicle rolls up, a big truck, and they drop the back gate, and there's a machine gun in it, and they open fire on hundreds of Americans. The word is going to get back to a town called Malmedy, and this slaughtering of prisoners is going to take on the name the Malmedy Massacre. And this is going to, the knowledge of this is going to become so widespread so quickly that when elements of the 101st Airborne are called up in the town of Mormelon, France, they're told, hey, these Germans gunned down all these Americans. So that's going to really kind of set the tone for the rest of the campaign, is sort of no quarter asked, no quarter given. In fact, in Noville, intelligence officers had to go out and get their own prisoners, because if they sent guys out to get prisoners, they'd come back and say, oh, sorry, he tripped on a rock and died before we got him back to you. This becomes a very brutal, brutal campaign. Now, if I get back to Piper and his drive, he's going to be stopped just west of a town called La Glaize. And if you go to La Glaize today, you can see one of the very few last King Tiger tanks. It's outside on display. And the German, I have to tell you, that the German offensive, Piper's attack, was eventually snuffed out by elements of the 30th Infantry Division. But more importantly, there was a tank battalion, the 740th. Now, these guys got to France without tanks. And when the battle launches, they're basically sent to a motor pool full of damaged tanks, and they said, and the officer said, okay, now fix these tanks up and send them and drive them into battle. This is how prepared these guys were. And within 48 hours, I think, or maybe less, they had fixed three tanks, and they said, okay, go on and take on Piper with these three tanks. And fortunately, they caught the Germans at a bend in a road and knocked out three German tanks. And that was it for Piper. He said, okay, we've had enough trouble. We're not going to go forward anymore. And so the whole focus of this entire campaign is snuffed out by some tankers that are the handful of tankers that are scooped up and thrown onto the battlefield in tanks they had never been in before. And then they're part of pushing Piper all the way back into Germany. So it really is, on a lot of levels, an ad hoc reaction to this German attack. Even in Bastogne, they were, you know, arming cooks and orderlies to, you know, with weapons and saying, get out there and fight. It really was the U.S. Army basically using every fiber of its existence to turn back this big attack by Hitler.
Retaliation.
Yeah.
How did the American, I mean, if it were me, I'd have been shooting every single prisoner I saw from that point on. I'm going to be honest with you. And how did the American Army, and I mean, I want to ask this, how did they control that?
Well, that's a good question. The simple answer is officers being Johnny on the spot. You know, officers refusing to allow their men to shoot prisoners. I wish I could give you some specific examples, but like I said, intelligence officers themselves had to go get their own prisoners on the front line because of the concern of soldiers shooting prisoners. It really was, I hate to say epidemic, but it really just became the nature of the battle. I interviewed a guy with the 2nd Armored Division, and he told me that people would say, you know, how could you shoot other people? You know, how could you even do that? And he said, it's easy. Once they kill a friend of yours, you know, all bets are off. And he said, there were guys in my division, and this guy fought in North Africa, Sicily, and then, you know, across Europe. So, I mean, he experienced this early on. He said, there were guys in our unit who, they let it be known, I will never take a prisoner, you know. And I think that's a shocking thing to people who have not been at war when an army first engages the enemy. But as you grind down over time at war, a lot of those sort of rules of civilization are considered frivolous, and they go out the window. And that's, you know, sort of the horror of war is its daily, I guess, dehumanization of people, that becomes a sort of the base attitude.
I have Eric here, and I'm going to get to Drake in just a second, but Eric was in Afghanistan. I know it's not the same war. Right, right. But what about prisoners there? Were the guys tempted to shoot them after they saw their buddies? And tell us about that, Eric.
Well, the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan during the time that I was there from early 2003, January to August of that year, we didn't have the opportunity to... engage in that manner of conflict. Our mission was more humanitarian. However, no, we were very aggressive when it came to taking prisoners for questioning.
But you didn't shoot them.
No, there. I never witnessed any interactions like that specifically, and I don't recall hearing anything like that either.
Well. And I bet your commander said, you know, bring them back so we can get intel. But when you were out, and you were both in Afghan and Iraq. All right. So
yes.
You're out there in the field, and there ain't nobody looking over your shoulder. Was that, what's the question here? What do I want to say? I want, help me with that. I
mean, how
I
mean did that
there's nobody
dilemma...
watching. Was the tempt, I'm not asking you personally, but did you, when you're talking to your colleagues, and I should have shot that SOB. Is that true?
Conversation among soldiers, it absolutely happened. It was something that we talked about when presented with that opportunity. How do we respond? You know, part of the conversation is our training. We're trained or we're taught that absolutely not. We don't do that. You know, we have a standard to uphold when it comes to the rest of the world looking at us. But we admit as soldiers to each other, yeah, that temptation is there, absolutely.
If I could add in real quick about that, you know, there's the question about the enemy. Well, there's also the question about civilians. And, you know, during the Battle of the Bulge, you know, the Belgians were so happy to see American troops when we entered Bastogne that they were actually handing out soup and bread to the soldiers as they marched to Noville and to the other areas around Bastogne. And I had the privilege of speaking to the first of the 506 at Fort Campbell earlier this week, and their battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Ferris, when I finished speaking, he stood up and he said, you know, and I had talked about all aspects of the battle, and he could pick apart anything he wanted to that I had said and tell it to the officers and NCOs. And he said, think about what he said about the Americans and the civilians, that, you know, they're happy to see Americans, and that's the way it should always be. We are there to help other people out, the people. And, you know, and I've written about Afghanistan and Iraq, where you didn't know if the local populace was with you or against you, but it was always indicative of the American troops to treat civilians with respect, let them know that you're protecting them, that they're going to be safe under your tenure there. And a lot of that does bear out from the Battle of the Bulge and World War II and our, you know, incredibly humane treatment of civilians.
Hey, Kevin, this is for both you and Eric. Now, Eric, you were in battles in 2003, I'm assuming 2004, right?
Okay. Yes.
So there's definitely that aspect of American exceptionalism and dealing with prisoners, the enemy, and the rules of war, et cetera. However, I can't help but think that the media coverage is so different now compared to what it was during World War II. In essence, I'm assuming that in World War II, the message was controlled, there was censorship, and in the present day, soldiers in the field, you're almost guilty until proven innocent, and they're always looking for the ability to frame you in the worst light. Not always, but to make a story maybe out of something that, you know what I'm getting at. And with technology, it blasts around the world within seconds.
Well, yes, there's some truth to that with how the media responds and covers these kind of stories. Just in my personal experience or personal opinion on what that looks like is, you know, a victim is always politically correct. It makes news, those kind of stories, mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that's not to say that the exceptionalism of the American soldier doesn't exist
absolutely.
At the same
I agree.
Time.
I agree. Yeah. No, I wasn't trying to diminish that either. I was just bringing up that aspect of it, the media now versus then.
Okay, Kevin, you got the last...
That, what a old saying that a rumor can race around the world before the truth is out of bed.
Yeah.
I like it.
Kevin, we've got 5 minutes. You don't have to fill the whole thing, but you get the last comment. Go ahead.
Sure. 73 years ago, Adolf Hitler made his last stab to sort of take over the earth, and American troops stopped him. These guys from the farms and small towns of America sacrificed their lives and went overseas to put down this evil without asking anything for it. I'll just give you a quick example. I remember when the World War II Memorial was being built, there was some protest against it, and that protest was coming from World War II veterans. And I asked one of them why he wasn't for it. And he said, "Kevin, a free world was our memorial." And I thought that was the perfect response. And, the conditions that it was fought in, the snow and the frost, were so unforgiving, yet these Americans gave their all to snuff it out and make this a better world. And for that, I think people who learn about these kind of things are always appreciative of the sacrifice that it took to accomplish that task.
All right, I do have one. I'm going to give you another minute here because I want you to talk about I want you to talk about your book. It's a coffee table book, folks. It's great Christmas, whatever. You can get it on Amazon. Patton's Photographs. Give us a minute on that, Kevin.
Sure. I found Patton's photo albums in the Library of Congress in the Manuscript Division, and they had never really been explored before. And as I started flicking through the pages, looking at all these different photos, I realized I had never seen any of them before. I'd never seen them in any books before, and came to realize, oh my gosh, these are the photographs General Patton took with his own camera from the moment he stepped on the sand in North Africa and Morocco for the last day and up to about 10 days before his death. And it didn't tell a different story about Patton. It just told a more in-depth story because I was privileged to look at the war through his eyes. The things that he saw and thought were important, he snapped a photo of. And so you really get to see the war through his eyes. And I always wondered, what if George Washington had a camera, or Ulysses S. Grant, or Robert E. Lee? Because you're always trying to get inside the head of your subject. And here you're seeing exactly what they saw, and you can imagine how that affected them. And so I picked what I thought were the most significant photographs, put them in a book, did some extra, legwork and research into Patton, and Martin Blumenson, my mentor, helped me through the whole thing. And the book was quite successful, and it's given me a lot of opportunity to be on wonderful shows like this. And I still get questions about it. The book came out, I think, 2006. But it's something I'm very proud of. And if you want a great introduction to Patton or just want to know another level of General Patton, it's, I think, a great book to read. I think it's a great book no matter what, since I'm the author. I'm a little biased, I have to admit.
Kevin, we're going to have to say goodbye now. I think the orchestra's picking up. They're getting ready. Would you please come back on sometime in the spring when we can talk about that whole thing coming up there? That's called D-Day. I think you'd like to talk about that. Would you come back?
I would love to talk about that.
Okay. You have a blessed New Year and a blessed Christmas to you and your family. Thank you very much for giving up your Sunday today.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Wow. Isn't that something?
Yeah. I mean, appreciate the info he brings.
To have all that information and to do all that research, what'd you think of that?
It's impressive that you can ask a relatively simple question and you get such a wealth of information right off the cuff.
And you can tell that you're barely scratching the surface with this guy. He's got reams and reams and reams of more information to give if he had the time. And I wanted to thank Eric for your service. And, folks, you can't see Eric in the studio, but he looks like the American hero.
Oh, he's
the
handsome.
Build, the looks. I mean, you see this guy. He belongs in Hollywood.
Guy.
He's a Hollywood soldier, and he's the real deal.
He's a handsome
thank
guy.
Thank you very much, Drake.
I'll bet you his wife, Holly. I know I'm supposed to say hello to Holly. Hello. She's listening, I'm sure, right now. She's going to hear it. It's one way or the other.
Yes.
Okay, right. So how are we doing? Oh, here comes the band. Here comes the theme music. Don't forget next week, it's Christmas Eve next week, so there's going to be Christmas music throughout the day at Wham. Oh, 10 seconds. So, until 2 weeks at New Year. You are dismissed.